This is Rebecca Lowe, or Rebecca Lua, if you listen to Suboptimal Radio, and you are listening to Men in Blazers on the NBC Sports Network.
It's unbelievable!
Men in Blazers may be about soccer, but we love a lot of American sports. Baseball has always enthralled us, being as it is chess with chewing tobacco. We follow hockey because, well, frankly, we do whatever Jeremy Roenick tells us. But since moving to America, the NBA has always been sporting catnip. It is, after all, like watching a five-a-side soccer game featuring only players who have the handling mastery of elite goalkeepers. Now that we're deep in the NBA Finals, we thought we'd do a special Men in Blazers NBA pod. Though truth is, I've long been looking for an excuse to track down and interview a personal hero of mine. If you'll allow me a moment of personal history. Lured by repeat screenings of Ferris Bueller, I moved to Chicago in the early 1990s. 2 days after I arrived in the city, Michael Jordan announced his first retirement. Despite that, I fell in love with the Jordanless balls of Tony Kukoc. When MJ returned, I reveled in the team's second three-peat, watching the Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman balls every night without fail. But it was not the stars who sucked me in. I fell in love with the squad players, BJ Armstrong, Judd Bushler, Randy Brown and Corey Blunt, all of whom had to swallow their ego and learn to play precise, niche roles, none more than starting centre Luke Longley, the giant Australian who went out every night and ground out his game against some of the NBA's greatest big men, a basketballing everyman, albeit a rare breed of everyman who is over 7 foot tall. Back then, I was a greenhorn, learning about the wonders of America on a daily basis. Perhaps that's why Luke was always an inspiration to me, a bloke who arrived on these shores with nothing, found cult fame and fortune, and worked his way onto the greatest team to ever play basketball, winning 3 NBA titles in the process. A man who trekked from Western Australia to the west side of Chicago and back again, an incredible life journey. Our guest today is a big man whose name will forever be etched into the NBA's annals. A 3-time finals champion, the first Australian to play in the league, our favourite New Mexico Lobo of all time, and a giant of a man standing 7 foot 2 inches tall. He's a bloke who played the game with a permanent grin and who became a cult figure because neither sharks, body surfing injuries, nor scorpion bites could stop him. Calling us from Southern Australia, we welcome to the pod a personal hero of mine, the great Mr. Luke Longley.
Well, that's the very best introduction I've had in a very long time. Thank you very much.
You deserve it on a daily basis, as far as I'm concerned, Luke. You grew up in Fremantle, Australia in 1969. What did you know of the NBA when you were growing up? Did you know about the NBA growing up?
No, not at all. In those days, basketball was a very marginal sport in Australia, and in particular West Australia. And the first I knew of the NBA was when I would have been about 12 or 13 and Converse hit Australia in a big way. I think the Chuck Taylors were the shoe at the time.
Still are.
It was a canvas thing. Yeah. Well, they were state of the art back then. And they had the Larry Bird, Moses Malone, and I think Magic Johnson had just started playing. Anyway, the Converse posters, that was all I ever knew. My heroes were local guys and football players, Australian football players.
Well, what did you actually dream of doing professionally when you were a kid, Luke?
I want to be a marine architect, was my wife always teasing me about. I was in love with the water and I wanted to build underwater houses. That was my childish dream.
You moved to the United States. It was somewhat serendipitous. A number of American college coaches journeyed to Perth to get a better look at a young Andrew Vlahov, but it was you who caught their eye. Do you remember playing harder when the American coaches came into town, or did the invitation to move to New Mexico and become a Lobo come out of the blue?
Well, you've certainly done your research, but what happened was I was a booby prize. They came to the coach in New Mexico came down to Perth to get Andrew off, and Andrew had already pretty much made up his mind to go to Stanford, and I wasn't interested in Stanford. I was more interested in other things. And so he asked me to come along for his workout, and I actually showed up without my shoes because I'd been at the beach. And but I was dunking left-handed and shooting jumpers and goofing off, which was all I really knew how to do at 15, I think it was. So Andrew told him the next day he was going to Stanford, and I was just kind of the next kid in line. But I think they obviously saw something because I was so tall and I had two hands and could catch and chew gum at the same time, so they recruited me.
You moved to this. I love reading about you because you moved to New Mexico, and I try and put myself in your shoes, even though you were shoeless when you went to meet the coaches. The transition, it must have been amazing. One minute you're an 18-year-old playing in front of 1,000 or so fans in Australia. The next, you're in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the pit. How must it felt running out the tunnel into an American college stadium for the first time?
Well, first of all, most I'd ever played in front of was about 150. The second thing was, what I did know is that when I got to New Mexico, I had just been legally allowed to drink beer in Australia at 18. And the coaches didn't tell me that the drinking age in America is 21. So I got off the plane and the coach had told me at lunch and I thought, oh, this would be great, I'll have a beer. And I wasn't allowed to have a beer, of course. And I was annoyed. You know, it's a big thing when you come of age in Australia, you're allowed to have a beer. And so that was one absolute bummer when I got to New Mexico. But as soon as I ran out of the pit, so there's a tunnel that comes down underneath the stadium and sort of out. You just sort of emerge into the pit, and I'm actually getting chicken skin talking about it now. But there's no better environment. Even in United Center, there was no better environment for me to run out into and play basketball than the pit. The fans just love it, and they're feral there too. You know, they're not sort of in boxes. They're down on the court throwing things at you. It's great.
It's unbelievable to know how close to a great NBA career almost ended when you got off the plane, realised you couldn't have a beer and probably almost got on the next. You should have moved to England. We start drinking at 12, Luke. You were drafted 7th overall in the 1991 draft. In came the Minnesota Timberwolves. For the record, the players in order that came before you: Larry Johnson, Kenny Anderson, Billy Owens, Dikembe Mutombo, Steve Smith, Doug Smith. That night, you were chosen by the Timberwolves. Wow. You became an instant millionaire. Could you believe it?
Mate, I couldn't believe it. I'll tell you what I couldn't believe, though, was when 6 months later I had to scratch a big check for half of the salary and give it back to the government. That was the biggest shock. But I suppose I'd been expecting to be an NBA player for a while, for about 2 years, because the scouts had been coming around. But certainly when I went to college to go to America, I mean, I'd seen the movie Animal House. You've seen that John Belushi movie, Animal House?
Yeah, they show you immigration when you arrive from England.
That's right. Well, I went to college basically on the premise that I like the look of that. That was the go. And I wasn't going there to be an NBA player. I was going there to have fun. And you know, it sort of, that was a little bit the theme of my whole career. While I did get more serious than that along the way and took the bit by the teeth, I suppose I was expecting to be an NBA player once I'd played against a few guys that were going that direction and realised I was okay.
You were really just frankly surprised that John Belushi wasn't your teammate when you arrived in Chicago.
I never went to a toga party. That was the worst bit.
We can still fix that, Luke, when you're next here. A 7 foot, we'd have to get a 7 foot two toga. I'm not sure if they make them that big. That's a lot of bed sheet.
Might have to make it out of a sail.
There's a bit of marine architect in you to this day. But the transition to the pro game, it must have been immense. You played in the era of big guys. You told an Australian magazine, I was effectively a monster, but a monster with small teeth. And looking at those days, looking at NBA, there were plenty of big teeth. The Ewings, the Shaqs, the Alonzo Mournings. Were the nights in your first season when you were about to go out and face, in your language, a real monster, a big tooth monster, and feel fear?
My first year or two, I was a long way from being properly competitive. I never felt physically scared. I think I've always been pretty comfortable with that side of it. Never been intimidated physically, but I did feel out of my depth from a skill package point of view. I felt like a bit of an imposter early on. You know, these guys had really developed serious game and serious bodies, and I was out there sort of trying, but I was a kid from Australia and I wasn't taking myself too seriously, and Australians tend not to a little bit. You know, I was a bit self-effacing and not very confident, to be honest. It was a confidence thing. I was never scared, but I was overwhelmed quite a lot.
Who was your most dominating opponent?
My very lowest moments on the basketball court came against David Robinson in my first first couple of years in the NBA, when he was, the Admiral was just an absolute machine. And he was the thing that I couldn't compete with. He was fast and he could jump. So if he was slow and grounded, I could kind of wrestle him a bit. But he was very hard to handle. But the worst moment was about 3 years ago. I was at the All-Star Game in Orlando. I was a guest that's irrelevant. I was there to sort of fart around the edges of the event, and I met the Admiral in the lounge, in the bar, one night, and I sort of joked with him about giving me 50 twice in one season. And he looked perplexed, and he didn't even know. I'm scarred, perennially, still forever scarred by being given 50 twice by the same bloke in one season. And he was confused. He didn't know what I was talking about. So he dished up a lot of hurt to a lot of people, and me probably, not least of which.
Did he just think you were a rather large 7'2" admirer?
He was cooler than that, but he didn't know what was going on. His kids were there, so I was actually trying to pump him up in front of his kids. You know, you do that, make people feel good about themselves in front of their kids. And I think it worked.
Oh, I need to have you around for dinner. You can tell my kids I got 50 on you one night. During the 93-94 season, the gift of a lifetime, Luke, you were traded Phil Jackson's Chicago Bulls. What made Phil Jackson such an effective coach?
Oh, good question. Well, I can only really speak, first of all, in my case. Phil managed to communicate that he believes in the things that I could do well better than I did myself, that he understood my weaknesses and would try not to put me in a position where they were exposed and help me work on them in the meantime. But I felt like I'd found a basketball home. He spoke the same language. He spoke about moving the ball and spacing and timing and all the things that I'd grown up thinking basketball was about. And I got to the NBA and everyone's playing hero ball, and I was standing over on the shoulder, you know, while somebody isolated went one-on-one, and I really didn't dig that at all. And I think that was Phil's magic, was his inclusiveness. He managed to make everyone, all the way through to, you know, the number 12 guy on the bench, feel included and clear about their role and appreciated. And, you know, that may all sound a bit trite and sappy, but it's actually, you know, to me, and I coach now, I'm assistant coach of a national team, I still think that is the number one ingredient for coaching. You mobilise guys, and he did that with me.
I read that he once told you, you said you told the Chicago Tribune that he told you to, quote, think of myself as Charlie Watts, the Rolling Stones drummer. He'd say, just keep the beat, don't try and be the lead singer.
That's exactly what he told me, and it was bloody good advice, because I can keep a beat, but I can't sing for shit.
Charlie Watts, always the coolest, as far as I'm concerned. The season after you joined the Bulls, Michael Jordan returned to basketball. You were quoted afterwards as saying, I had never played with anyone that good. Can you describe the kind of immense adjustments you had to make as an individual when MJ returned?
Yeah, mate, well, the adjustments were many. First of all, the level of expectation went up on the court and off the court in every which way. The intensity of our practices went up. Our practices became more intense in the games. The scrutiny went through the roof. You know, my little basketball insecurities about not being able to do this or that, which is, let's be frank, what drives, I think, a lot of athletes is the things you can't do. So you're trying to get better all the time. Suddenly they were glaring. But amongst all of that, there was this, you know, this jewel, this guy that could do anything on the basketball court and dictate you know, the movements of nine other guys. He was extra sensory, you know. He could do things that no one else had. I really hadn't seen anyone do. I hadn't even really played against him. My first year or two in the league, I think I probably bumped up against him. I didn't really appreciate him. He was, he had a charisma, he was incredible with his charisma, the way people were drawn to him, and people were also intimidated by him. I was intrigued by him, but he was just, he was something else.
I mean, this was a team, for anyone too young to have watched them firsthand, that was stacked with personalities. It was MJ, Pippen, Rodman, yes, but Steve Kerr, Tony Kukoc, Bushla, Wennington. Who were you closest to on these Bulls teams?
Yeah, probably, I suppose, Jug Bushla and Steve Kerr. Tony Kukoc, I loved them all. I really, really enjoyed Randy Brown, James Edwards. He was on the team for a while. I loved Robert Parrish. I thought he was great. Even though I couldn't get him to chat to me much, he was sort of quiet fella. Scottie Pippen, I still keep in touch with a bit. I found him a fantastic teammate and a really good teacher on the floor. He was certainly more of a teacher than MJ was.
You once told the Chicago Tribune, one of my jobs on the team was mediating between some of the different groups, keeping everyone on the same page. Can you give us a sense of the different groups and give us an example of how you played that role?
Well, different groups varied in different circumstances, but certainly Dennis was his own group in his own orbit with his own, four or five Dennises that he hung out with. You never knew which one was going to show up. So he was an independent group. And I think that was probably the best example. I managed to find a way to be around Dennis and relax with Dennis, where I don't think a lot of the other guys could do that. I think being Australian helped too. I was sort of wasn't anything. I was sort of bridged a lot of demographics and sort of social things that Americans might otherwise feel. And I just tried to use humour and levity. I was the guy that took it the least seriously. So my seriousness was all adopted and learned and borrowed from the other guys, and I'm hoping that they learned and borrowed a little bit of my levity.
Did you ever do a night out with Dennis Rodman?
Yeah, but I don't know if we're going to go much further with that line of questioning, but absolutely, yes. That was part of how you related to Dennis. And let's face it, any sportsman, any sports team has, they have nights out together. That's how they get to know each other and outside of the game. So, I hung out with Dennis. He's one of a kind. There'll never be another Dennis, and let's hope not.
Togas. All I'll say is when you do bring out your autobiography, Luke, that should be its own volume. Save it for your autobiography. MJ was known for his lack of patience and high expectations. What's the most severe thing you saw Michael Jordan do to a Bulls teammate?
Well, it was his withering look, and he shared it with everybody, and he didn't spare me very many. So if you dropped a pass or missed a play, that intensity was laser beam. And he didn't need to say much more than that.
I read a great Michael Jordan story for you. The night he praised you at halftime against Detroit when you returned to the locker room. Do you remember that? You returned to the locker room, 18 points, half a dozen rebounds, couple of blocks. Michael Jordan, for the first time, you told the Tribune he was very cautious with his praise. He came into the locker room, high five, slapped me, hugged me, and said, "Man, you play like that, we're going to win the world championship. You are an all-star. Why don't you play like that every day?" I knew you had it in you. What happened, Luke?
Well, you know the story, mate. I went out the second half and laid an egg. I was so excited. I went out the second half, got a couple of quick fouls, and sat on the bench the rest of the half. Anyway, Michael came in the locker room after the game and basically said he was never, ever, ever going to give me one word of praise as long as he lived. But that's Michael, Michael actually thought that he had such an influence on everything that his praise had caused the egg. He'd had that much belief in his own influence. And, maybe he had some influence in it. But, I'm entirely capable of laying an egg all by myself. Thank you very much.
I love that. I wish I could lay an egg. I remember watching you, along with Will Perdue and Bill Wennington, taking on Shaquille O'Neal under instructions to foul them intentionally. Hacker Shaq, it became known as. He was a 52.7% career free thrower. Every time he got the ball, one of you would take him out. As a professional basketball player, what was it like to execute that strategy, forced to practice the dark art?
Yeah, well, it was novel, for sure. It's not novel anymore, it seems to be. They're doing the first quarter these days. Well, put it this way, it wasn't, I didn't mind it. It was fun. One game in particular, we were playing against LA, against Shaq. Long story short, the guys on the team used to call me Mad Rise sarcastically because I had no elevation at all, couldn't jump at all. And Shaq's offensive end was right in front of our bench. And when they came down at the end of the quarter, we were down by 3 or 4 points, and they got into Shaq and a foul him, and he missed 2 free throws. And then we went down the other end, and Michael hit a jumper, came back, same thing. Shaq missed 2 free throws, went down, and I think probably I hit a jumper then, and we're now down by 1. Go back down to in front of our bench again, and they stupidly passed the ball into Shaq in deep position. I fouled him a third time. And he got so frustrated, he just decided to jump anyway, and I was riding on his back, and the guys on the bench reckon that was the highest I ever got off the floor on Shaq's back. So,
Mad Rise!
Mad Rise was in full effect just riding Shaq. He was a beast.
If the NBA was an adjustment for you, it must have been an enormous adjustment for your family. I mean, you were the Luke they knew and loved was suddenly starting on basketball's greatest team. I remember an old Chicago Trib story about your grandmother, Claire, coming over to watch you at the United Center during the playoffs. Do you remember what happened?
She got very, very upset because she thought everyone was booing me. And, of course, they were chanting Luke in the hope that I might do something worthwhile. But she thought it was boos and she was ready to leave. She was a funny old dear. But,
The Tribune said that everyone when you got, if you didn't watch Luke play, everyone when you got the ball, what was the noise they'd make whenever you got the ball?
Oh, it was a big droney, that sort of thing.
And your grandmother Claire thought you were being booed and she left the stadium in tears. They were being mean to her grandson.
Not happy.
But you,
she played all the way from Melbourne at the age of 82 or whatever she was to see me play, and she was she didn't take it well.
I'm sure she was very proud of Mad Rise. The first championship against Seattle, you won at home, 72-10 season, a record. The clock was winding down to under a minute. You were up by double digits. The game was over. You looked around the crowd. Do you remember what you felt, Luke?
Yeah, I do, mate. It was a funny. You're leading me into some dark alleys. I actually just wanted to go down back to locker room and be in the quiet. I was just overwhelmed. I wasn't elated. I wasn't jumping on scoring benches. I just felt this overwhelming sense of personal achievement, of pride. But it was a private moment for me, shared with 25,000 screaming fans and a bunch of teammates were pretty excited, but I sort of collapsed inwards, which was really, to this day, I don't really understand why or exactly what happened, but it was strong, for sure.
Was it because a journey that you'd set out on, a crazy journey from Western Australia to the west side of Chicago had almost been completed?
Yeah, I think it was obviously a lot of that. It was just such an improbable thing in my personal landscape. It was just so improbable. And yet, as it turned out, I had invested myself in it entirely. And as you probably know, I was the first Australian to do anything like that. So I did feel an enormous sense of pride being an Australian. And for my basketball family back in Australia who a lot of people, including myself, never saw it coming and didn't think I was going to be a great basketballer, and I think just falling into Phil's arms, so to speak, and playing in a system that suited me and included me, and having MJ and Scotty and Dennis and those guys on the team obviously helped. But it was a culmination thing, and I suppose the stereotypical idea is that you become elated and burst with joy, and run around, hug everyone, and rip your gear off and get excited. But I had exactly the opposite experience.
You won three championships, Luke. Does the emotion remain the same, or does the experience kind of, you become battle-hardened, used to it with each one?
Certainly the first one is the one when I think of winning a championship, I always think of that first one, no doubt. And it was because it was so powerful. But not to say that the two and three weren't exciting, and you know, certainly never ever took it for granted, never felt as if we were going to get it, really. Even in 72 and 10 years, it just felt improbable. But yeah, the first one was the special one for me, no doubt. And I'd have to ask Phil that question 13 rings on, eh, and see if he even remembers the first one.
I think he only kept winning just to prove he could do it without you, Luke, on the squad. He needed to prove that to himself. what was the most important lesson you learnt from Michael Jordan in that time?
I learned a lot from Michael. I learned a lot from the experience. Probably that there's always a place for humour, you know. even in the most intense competitive brain on the planet, there's always a place for humour, and it's a great equaliser.
You were traded to Phoenix for a trio of players and a first-round pick. Your cult status was cemented in April 2000 when you kept playing after being stung by a pair of scorpions, one on the foot, the other on your bum cheeks. You told the media that you were sitting on the floor sorting out CDs. Luke, I love bizarre injuries. Can you just tell us the story?
Yeah, mate, it's not that bizarre. I'll tell it to you anyway. So I had a house on the side of a mountain in Phoenix, and the floor was made out of the same material as the mountain. It was this sort of brown stone that came tumbling in out of the mountain and became my floor. It was a pretty cool house. And it's hot in Phoenix. And I was sitting around in my basketball shorts was all I was wearing, no undies, nothing. And my wife, like everyone else's wife, cannot, in those days could not, because she's not my wife anymore, alphabetize anything. She just shoved them back in the case, however I came, however she could be bothered. So,
like you're talking about your Midnight Oil CD collection.
No, I didn't let her near that. I didn't leave those on the shelf. They're in the safe. And so once in a while I have to pull them out. Anyway, so I pulled them out, and I was halfway through, got thirsty, went to get up to go to get a drink, and I felt this searing pain in my foot. And I had some unlucky injuries in my life, and I thought, oh no, I can't believe I've torn my plantar fascia getting up off the floor. So I limped over to the sink, not knowing that I'd been bitten by a scorpion, just thinking that I'd injured my foot somehow. Got a bag of ice and went back to sit down to do the CDs and sat right on the same stupid scorpion and then bit me on the arm. So it wasn't a pair of scorpions, it was the same bloody one.
I love that. You told the Tucson Citizen, they asked you why you played, why you kept playing when you've been stung by a scorpion twice, and you told them, I could just see the injury report at, quote, ass bite.
DNP ass bite.
You kept playing through 2001. You even came to the Knicks in this fair city. But you said upon retirement, it was a forced retirement through injury. I just didn't really want to be around the sport very much afterwards. Basketball felt a bit like an old girlfriend. Did you just cut yourself off cold turkey, or did you remain in touch with kind of NBA teammates and the NBA life?
Well, unfortunately, in the meantime, I had bought the local professional basketball franchise called the Perth Wildcats, and with Andrew Vlahov, my old teammate. And so I sort of remained connected to the sport as the owner and reluctant owner of that franchise, storied franchise here in Australia, which I later sold. And I kept in touch with a few of my teammates, but I didn't have, my ankle sort of went to mush, and I didn't have I'd fallen out of love with the game. It's as simple as that. You know what it's like. I'm sure you've fallen out of love before. Interestingly, though, I've sort of found it again in the last 3 or 4 years and started doing a bit of coaching with our national team and really, really enjoying it.
Are you in touch with many of the Bulls? You said you're still in touch with Scottie Pippen. What about Steve Kerr? From what you know of him from your Bulls days, is it any surprise he's experiencing success as a coach?
Yep, I keep in touch with Steve, and I have done all along. And Phil and I often have said that we thought that he would be a coach one day. And Phil said to me, I suppose, more than me saying to Phil, but I never doubt it. I thought Steve would do it one day, and he's always been cut out for it. He processes things all the time, and he's an astute, great study on people. He really does read people very, very well, and the game too, but the coaching's more about the people, and it seems to be doing a good job of that.
You talked about your new role as an assistant coach with the Australian national team. Australian teams always have the best nickname, the Boomers. Australian basketball, it's a coming force. Ton of that Aussie talent. Dante Exum, Matthew Dellavedova, Andrew Bogut, future stars Ben Simmons and Ton Macquarie. How have you adapted to your role as an Aussie basketball founding father, the first Australian to play in the NBA, to win in the NBA, a trailblazing pioneer?
That's funny because, I've adapted well. I'm really enjoying it. I think your rap for me is much bigger than any rap I've had in the last 10 years. And the Australians don't do it that way. I don't get a lot of pats on the back for what happened before. We're all sort of busy looking towards Rio. And it is a bit of a golden era. We've got some great players coming through and some Bogues. You know, Andrew Bogut is a bit older, and I think we've got a nice mix. The head coach, Andre Lamana, I really believe is one of the best coaches I've been around, which is why I took the job. And the guys on the team seem to respond well to me in the way that I approach the game and approach them and communicate with them and try to bring a bit of levity to it as well. It is really good fun, and it's such a great game that it's nice to be around it again.
I mean, I genuinely loved watching you play. And when I've been trying to think about why, I mean, you played the game with an absolute joy on your face at all times. I mean, I just a delight. You read anything about you now, and one of the first comments is always how you kind of try and play down your achievements, your disdain for memorabilia. You still have 3 championship rings from the NBA, Luke. How often do you look at them, and what emotions do you experience when you look at them?
Well, 2 of them are in a museum somewhere. I'm not sure where. Well, I've got one of them I keep in the gun safe, of all places. When I look at them, I do get immensely proud. You know, I don't revisit the memories of the Bulls. I have never sat down and watched the games. I sort of try not to dwell on the past, but when I do look at those rings, I do get flushed with pride. There's no doubt about it. I'm immensely proud of it, and my life wouldn't be the same without that experience. There's no doubt it's part of what made me who I am, and I'm just the luckiest 7-foot ginger getting around. That's all I can say.
We love gingers on this show, so it's a beautiful point to bring this to a close. But if you're asked to say, what, if anything, do you miss most about life in America, Luke? How would you answer?
Oh, well, that's an easy one for me. In America, and I'm going to steal a quote from an article I did recently. I'm going to steal my own quote. In Australia, if you drive a red, yellow Bentley convertible down the street, everyone thinks, what a wanker. In America, you drive a yellow Bentley down the street and everyone thinks, nice car, mate, well done. There's just a different approach to success and to striving for success in America. That's the bit that I miss. Not that I have a yellow Bentley, nor do I want one, but I do like that acceptance of people striving in America. That's the one thing I miss.
Every yellow Bentley owner that is listening to this show is rushing to Google right now to look at what wanker means. but I've got to say, Luke, what a life you've lived. What a journey you've experienced. We've got a very young audience. If you had to tell them the most important lesson of life, according to Luke Longley, what would you say?
Oh, mate, are you serious? Do you really want me to share my life lessons with your audience?
We can't wait for your autobiography, Luke. Come on.
That's funny. Okay, I'll play with the straight bat for the moment, and I would say it's the things that don't get said that do the most damage. There you go.
You've just mucked with my head. You've mucked now with... And people who are not just driving yellow Bentleys probably are now deeply insecure, but I love it. We adore it. I have to tell you, I want you to know, it is an absolute thrill to speak to you. We have many guests on this show, but you have unleashed kind of the boyhood fan in me. And I know thousands of others who'll be listening to this. We are grateful to you. We cannot wait for you next. How often do you get back to America, Luke?
Oh, not very often, mate. Once every couple of years, probably. Yeah, well, I don't have any foreseeable plans. I suppose I should come through America pre-Rio, on the way to the Rio Olympics would be the next time.
Well, we cannot wait to fete you in the style to which you're accustomed, the American style to which you're accustomed, not the Australian one. We're very grateful. Back to the dishes with your family, Luke, and thank you, mate.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute joy. I don't get to wander down those memories, those alleys very often. I really enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you, Luke.